Hello, I'm Alton Banks for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will be reading from the Triangle Business Journal. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. All right, well, as we turn the page to from this week's cover page for Triangle Business Journal, we find ourselves on the biz page where we have four or five little articles. And the first one of those this week is under the heading of Key Tenant. Lululemon plans new store in Cary. The Fenton development in Cary has landed another key retailer, Lululemon Athletica. The Canadian athletic apparel company has filed plans to bring a new retail location to the project, with around 3,600 square feet of space at 20 Fenton Main Street, Suite 170. Fenton is on target to open its first phase in April. The Lululemon opening is uncertain. Fenton developers are planning to open the first phase of the development in April. Other retailers heading to Fenton are Williams-Sonoma, Pottery Barn, Athleta, and Von Kekel Aveda Lifestyle Salon Spa. On the restaurant and dining side, businesses will include Scott Crawford's Crawford Brothers Steakhouse, Steve Palmer's Italian Restaurant Coletta, Michael Lee's M Sushi, Ford Fry's Tex-Mex Restaurant Superica, and Whiskey Bar Dram and Draft, owned by Drew Schenck and Kevin Barrett. And under the heading of Hot Location, the article, New Restaurant to Open in Chapel Hill. One of the busiest sections of downtown Chapel Hill is getting a new, authentic Himalayan restaurant. Momo's Master is set to open at 110 North Columbia Street near West Franklin Street in November, said owner Ramesh Dahal. The restaurant will feature various kinds of made-to-order momos. That's a type of dumpling that is popular in places such as Tibet and Nepal, where Dahal was born and raised. Businesses near the highly visible intersection of North Columbia and West Franklin Streets have not lasted long due to high rents. But Dahal said Momo's Master will have what it takes to survive. He has over 20 years of experience as a chef, including working at the Angus Barn in Raleigh and La Farm Bakery in Cary. And under the heading of Glowing Going Global, Longfellow makes a big move to the United Kingdom. A company that's rapidly building its presence in the Triangle is launching its first international expansion. Longfellow Real Estate Partners is planting its flag in the United Kingdom, the company announced recently, naming a London-based managing director for the UK. Longfellow is set to expand internationally, building off the successful track record in creating vibrant life science clusters and developments throughout the United States, the company said. Longfellow is behind some big projects in the region, including Durham ID and the Massive Hub RTP project, where Longfellow will develop a 220,000 square foot office tower. The company is heavily focused on life sciences space. Under the heading of Data Dive, the article Orange County Market Facts. The dynamic growth in Orange County is evident in a fascinating data dive provided by the area's Business Booster Group. Since 2017, commercial property in the county has risen 62% in value, outpacing the 34% for residential. But the value of apartments has risen even more, by 73%. But life in Chapel Hill is expensive. According to the report, the average residential property tax bill is $7,549. By comparison, Cary is $4,327. Raleigh is $3,349. Two other bits of information jump out as well. One is on obesity. The document details information from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, detailing that 32% of North Carolina adults are obese. In Orange County, that number is 22%, compared to 28% in both Wake and Durham counties. Also, people in Orange County are less likely to smoke. The report notes that 18% of North Carolina adults smoke, compared to 15% in Orange County, and Durham County had a 15% rate, with Wake County checking in at 14%. Also on this week's Biz page, under the heading of Opening Date Set, comes the article, New Hospital in Holly Springs. A new hospital is getting ready to open in fast-growing Holly Springs after being delayed because of the pandemic. UNC Rex had planned to open the hospital in September, but delayed that to focus on the surge of COVID-19 patients. Now the new Holly Springs Hospital will open November 1st at 7 a.m. The eight-story facility will include 50 inpatient beds and a full-service emergency room. It will employ 300 people at first and eventually more than 400. We're excited to open our new hospital and begin caring for patients in southwestern Wake County and beyond, says Roy Temke, chief operating officer of the hospital. We appreciate all the community support during these challenging times and look forward to providing excellent medical care at this hospital for generations to come. And finally, the seasonal article on the biz page under the heading of Leaf Peeping. Asheville foliage equals tourism. As leaves change across the North Carolina mountains, the Asheville area is seeing a surge of tourism and trends from the pandemic that may last. Hotel occupancy for September was 75%, according to figures from Victoria Isley, president and CEO of the Explore Asheville Convention and Visitors Bureau. That's well above the 60% from September of 2020, and even higher than the 73% from September 2019. But what's interesting is that rise isn't coming at the expense of vacation rentals. In fact, vacation rentals for August were at 70% of capacity, down slightly from 74% last August, but well above the 64% from 2019. In fact, both segments have continued to grow, says Isley, noting that the length of stays is growing as well. As in other markets, restaurants in the hospitality industry have struggled to staff the demand. Our restaurants continue to struggle somewhat with the workforce, Isley says, noting that many are limiting hours because of lack of workers. But the trend from the pandemic of longer trips as people take their laptops and work from anywhere is expected to continue, especially in destinations such as Asheville. Well, let's turn the page from the biz page, and we find ourselves on the transport and tech page of this week's TBJ. And under the heading of supply chain comes the article, New Ports Exec Sees Opportunities for North Carolina. As container ships stack up along the nation's busiest ports, North Carolina could see an opportunity. That's according to Brian Clark, the executive director of the North Carolina State Ports Authority, who says conversations have already been happened with shippers looking to diversify their supply chain as a way to mitigate what's been a pain point across the globe. Clark became executive director January 1st, taking over at a challenging time amid supply disruption and unprecedented shipping demand. North Carolina's ports in Wilmington and Morehead City are certainly seeing congestion, but not the same traffic jams first call ports have been experiencing in recent months, Clark says. Right now, Clark says the turnaround time at the port, is a point of pride. On the container side, it's tracking at 39 container moves per hour, ranked as a top performer in the Journal of Commerce. Truck turnaround time, where they drop off the old container and pick up a new one, is just over 30 minutes. North Carolina's ports for years have been working to accommodate more traffic, particularly on the container side, as the state looks to compete with the busier ports along the East Coast, such as Charleston, South Carolina. And it's working, Clark says. Right now, there are two Trans-Pacific services operated by two separate alliances on a weekly basis, but that's now. With the ongoing supply chain issue hitting the industry on multiple fronts, there's a lot of parties looking at options for diversifying their supply chain. But rerouting a vessel from its regular stop to North Carolina isn't a simple process. The shippers that are moving the cargo are expecting their cargo to arrive at a different location, Clark says, noting it causes a domino effect. But the longer the global supply chain issue lasts, the more rerouting could become a serious option. And conversations are happening, he adds. And under the heading of raising dollars comes the article, AI startup with UNC roots takes home top prize at big launch. An 8-minute pitch just landed lip-reading startup LIRA a $10,000 prize. LIRA took home first place at the ninth annual Big Launch Challenge pitch competition, held recently at the North Carolina Biotechnology Center. LIRA, a UNC Chapel Hill technology startup, co-founded by head and neck surgeon Dr. Andrew Prince, seeks to give the voiceless a voice. Inspired by Prince's experience of trying to communicate with patients unable to speak in the hospital, the firm got its start in 2019 during an entrepreneurship class. And under the heading of Red Hat comes the article, New CMO, New Branding Strategy. As Red Hat works to bring hybrid cloud computing to the masses under the IBM umbrella, it's promoting one of its own to lead the battle strategy when it comes to branding. Lee Day, a 22-year marketing veteran at the IBM-owned open-source software company, is being promoted to Chief Marketing Officer following the pending retirement of current CMO Tim Yeaton. Her plan is to move from mass marketing to more precision marketing, she says. You would come to our website and we would know who you were. So we would give you high-value experiences and information that are relevant to you personally, Day explains. Now moving on from the transportation and tech page to the real estate page. The major article on this page is under the heading of Major Project. And the article is Town Gets Reimagined. The town of Morrisville has picked a developer for the first phase of its town center project, with work expected to begin at the end of next year. Sing Development will lead the project, with current plans calling for commercial space and hundreds of new residential units, though plans have yet to be finalized with the town. Sing Development is a real estate firm with offices in Michigan and Cary. It's an exciting project. Marshall has a lot going for it, with everything happening in RTP and in the town already, says Avi Graywall, Sing Development project manager. He says construction could start in late 2022 or early 23, if everything goes smoothly with the town. The town center location is situated at the corner of Town Hall Drive and Carolina Street, at the site of the new Marshville Community Library, which opened last year. I'm so excited to work with Sing Development, Council Member Ann Robotti said in a statement. Their vision for our town center includes so many creative and innovative ideas that will make the space a true gathering center for our town. Town officials plan to have a development agreement in place next year. Sing Development's latest proposal calls for around 35,000 square feet of commercial space and around 250 residential units. The town kicked off the selection process in 2020, bringing on DFI, that's Development Finance Initiative, to create a phased development plan for the project. The group is a program of the UNC Chapel Hill School of Government, that works with local governments in attracting private investment for major projects. The town expects the entire project to be built out over several phases, with the first phase covered by Sing Development. Assuming a development agreement is reached and Sing does complete the first phase, the company will also purchase the land. Earlier this year, the town considered three developers, Casto, JRL Real Estate Company, and Sing Development, and then narrowed it down to two, though town officials declined to name who the other finalist was. And also on the real estate page, under the heading of Glenn Lennox, comes the article, Co-working Firm Snags Full Floor at New Chapel Hill Building. A co-working company has announced its entrance into Chapel Hill after signing on to a large space in Grub Properties' newly opened office building at Glen Lennox. Industrious has signed on to 27,000 square feet at the Gwendolyn, Grub announced. It's the first office tenant to sign on for space at the new building and joins Chapel Hill coffee shop Coco, which is relocating to the new building. The development is part of a massive re-imaging of a Glen Lennox neighborhood that dates to 1960, when Chapel Hill was seeing a boom after World War II. Rather than a traditional lease, Industrious has entered into a partnership deal with Grub Properties, in which their payments to the landlord are based on the amount received from Industrious members. The Gwendolyn is a four-story, 109,000 square feet, Class A office building located at 101 Glen Lennox Drive in the Glen Lennox community. Industrious's space is expected to open in quarter three of 2022 and will include private offices and shared workspaces as well as common areas and other amenities. Industrious will fill the entire third floor of the building, which opened this summer. Industrious provides private offices for lease in locations around the country and has been expanding its footprint in the Triangle for the last 4 years. The company currently has two locations in downtown Raleigh, one in the Wells Fargo Capital Center and the other in Charter Square. Now we turn the page and we reach the Greater Triangle Growth page, one of the newer pages in the Triangle Business Journal. And under the heading of New Homes comes the article, Building for the Era After the Pandemic. Home building may be an area ripe for change. Cary-based Garmin Homes is building a collection of homes in Chatham Park made for a post-COVID world. The 68-home community, called the Quotables Collection, features flexible spaces that become larger or smaller when needed. I call it a James Bond car, but it actually sounds more like a transformer, says Elena Money Garmin, CEO of Garmin Homes. It has all these different ways of creating safety, whether that be having guests at your home or only entertaining outside. The plan reflects all those different ways of embracing what post-COVID-like life looks like. The home design is based on feedback from 7,000 residents to the America at Home study, which asked people what they wanted in their home of the future. There's a guest suite with its own entrance where family members can fully quarantine but still communicate with the rest of the house via a glass pocket door. There's also a secret room located behind a bookcase in the primary suite as a nod to emotional well-being. I like to call it the room of emotional requirement, Money Garmin says. She says appetite for the homes is strong. Of the 68 total lots, 16 are sold. 10 homes are being built and not yet sold, and another 34 will be developed in the future. Garmin Homes just purchased 6 lots within Chatham Park for $540,000, according to a deed dated October the 5th. As Money Garmin says, the company is purchasing the lots on a rolling schedule. And finally, on the Greater Triangle Growth page this week, Under the heading of Rezoning Rejection comes the article, Vance County Housing Project Uncertain. The future of a planned housing development in Vance County is now unclear. David Chapman of Pinehurst-based Southbury Development says the plan was to build 165 single-family homes on 101 acres in western Vance County. The site is located along U.S. 158 Business between Henderson and Oxford. Chapman and the development team requested the land be rezoned to R10 for minimum lot sizes of 10,000 square feet. However, the commissioners denied the request and instead approving rezoning the land to R20 during the meeting this month. R20 zoning allows for a minimum lot size of 20,000 square feet. Chapman says in an email that he doesn't know if we can make the project work financially with a minimum number of lots under the R20 zoning and is hoping the commissioners reconsider. Next, we come to the healthcare and higher ed page of this week's journal. And under the heading of Ready to Roll is the article, French Firm Ramps Up at Its Raleigh Facility. 2 years after deciding to build its U.S. manufacturing facility in Raleigh, Cellectis is preparing to produce its first batch of material to send to clinical trials. The French-based gene editing company began producing training runs at the facility in May, followed by engineering runs for two of its products. We're finally ready to produce our first GMP material, says Steve Doomers, Senior Vice President of U.S. Manufacturing and site head of the facility. That's going to be the stuff that will find its way into patients eventually. The facility will produce three wholly owned allogeneic gene-edited T-cell product candidates designed to treat three cancer targets: multiple myeloma, acute lymphoblastic leukemia, and acute myeloid leukemia. The company's immunotherapy product candidates, called UCARTs, that's Universal Chimeric Antigen Receptor T-cells, began with T-cells from healthy donors. These cells then undergo a gene editing process to make sure the donor T cells only attack a patient's cancer cells. This gene editing process also prevents a patient's immune system from attacking the foreign cells. The company is testing these products in clinical trials at cancer centers throughout the U.S. and plans to expand to trials in Europe. The number of vials of UCARTs the company produces and ships at its Raleigh facility will depend on the number of these centers running these trials. With the opening of this manufacturing facility, the company will no longer outsource production and therefore could increase the number of trials it partners with. While it requires investment up front, shifting to internal production will likely be less expensive than outsourcing in the long term. About 75 people work at this facility, and that number continues to grow as the company hires new employees almost monthly. When it first announced the project in 2019, the company started with about 200 employees that will work at the facility when it's fully built out. It said at the time that the investment would reach nearly $69 million by the end of 2022. This will take a few more years. The company plans to begin construction on the second phase of the project in 2022, with it concluding sometime in 2024. And under the heading of Key Deal, the article Triangle CRO goes public after SPAC merger. The Triangle Clinical Research Organization has gone public after completing its merger with a special purpose acquisition company known as SPACs, Science 37, with headquarters in Raleigh and Los Angeles, announced its plans to combine with LifeSci Acquisition 2 Corp., a SPAC, earlier this year. LifeSci shareholders approved the transaction on October the 4th. The combined company, Science 37 Holdings, is listed on the NASDAQ under the ticker symbol SNCE. The merger delivers $235 million in cash to Science 37, money the company said would fund its decentralized trial technology platform and continued growth. As of the May announcement, the firm, founded in 2014, had engaged with more than 366,000 patients. As of October the 19th, Science 37 was trading at about $11.38 a share, the highest level since the merger IPO. Science 37 is the second local company after Humacyte to go public through this SPAC route following Durham-based Humacyte earlier this year. As we next turn the page, we encounter this week's executive voice. As you know, the executive voice is a Q&A column with a person in the Triangle area. And this week's executive voice belongs to Kim Hunter, whose hometown is actually York, the UK. Her education is from the University of East Anglia, as well as a JD from Georgetown University. The article is entitled "The Environment's Tireless Advocate." Kim Hunter's name is one that officials pay attention to in a courtroom. Over the years, she's represented the environmental interests, pushing back against some of the state's largest transportation projects, including the Complete 540 project. And while she's one of the key players behind a slew of courtroom compromises that have allowed major infrastructure products to move forward more responsibly, she's also gained a reputation of sticking to her guns when she feels it matters. In a Q&A, she talks through some of her biggest courtroom accomplishments and the land use challenge leaders continue to face in the state. Now, there are a lot of them, and I won't have time to read all of them, but I'm going to try to pick out the bigger ones. When did you decide to focus your legal career on advocating for the environment? Her answer, I've been passionate about environmental issues for almost as long as I can remember. As a tiny kid, I would collect and identify wildflowers along the verge with my grandmother in England. In the fourth grade, I enthusiastically led the school's nature club. Since then, I've gotten increasingly focused on climate change. I studied environmental sciences in college, where I delved into the political and policy approaches to mitigating greenhouse gases. After college, I realized that becoming an attorney would allow me to make the biggest impact. I still believe that is true. So what was your most memorable case? I'm engaged in litigation that's slightly unusual for an environmental attorney right now, representing the North Carolina NAACP in their challenge to two constitutional amendments. The case has stretched me in so many ways and taught me so much. It's such a privilege and an honor to stand with the NAACP and be a small part of their much longer struggle to get fair and just representation in our state. I enjoy all my cases, however. Heading litigation that ultimately contributed to the downfall of the Garden Parkway, a proposed $1 billion toll highway outside of Charlotte, was an extremely meaningful part of my career. The settlement we achieved on the Complete 540 project was another huge highlight. We were able to achieve so much for species conservation, watershed management, land acquisition, and climate change. What's an overlooked environmental issue? Her answer, land use, and how it contributes to climate change. A lot of our towns and cities in the Triangle have declared strong commitments to mitigating climate change, but the efforts are all focused on renewable energy, energy efficiency, and electrification. Until we get serious about land use patterns that reduce driving, we're not going to be able to make a meaningful climate impact. What was the first case you ever worked on? My first case was opposing the Monroe Bypass outside of Charlotte. I learned a lot about what a win looks like in this job. We got a big legal victory in the Fourth Circuit, which continues to pay dividends today in other cases. On the other hand, the road ultimately got built. We got a number of concessions and $1 million set aside for land conservation. What keeps you up at night? Our work is hard, and in general, the structures of power are pretty stacked against us. Sometimes it can feel like however hard we work and however right we are, it's almost impossible to win. But then I get up, work out, feel stronger, and get back to the fight. Last question. Do you have any mentors? Vicky Arroyo, who is now a prominent leader on climate in the Biden administration, was my mentor through law school and has been so important to me on both a professional and personal basis. In North Carolina, Chris Brook, formerly of the ACLU and the Court of Appeals, has taught me so much about to do our job well and effectively. Well, now we reach the cover story of this week's Triangle Business Journal, and that cover story is entitled Big Banks Getting Bigger. Its centenarian dominance started 122 years ago. That's when the legacy institutions, Durham Loan and Trust Company and Home Savings Bank, began. Banks that would soon make up Durham-based Central Carolina Bank and Trust. Historic names pepper its timeline, such as that of its founding president back in 1899, philanthropist John Sprunt Hill, who is credited with expanding UNC Chapel Hill. In the 1960s, CCB's four-sided sign, fabricated in sections from steel and coated with porcelain, was a symbol of success in the Bull City. In 1997, CCB merged with American Federal Bank of Greenville, South Carolina, becoming a $6.9 billion bank with no signs of a slowdown. Then, National Commerce Bank Corp. of Memphis, Tennessee, came calling in 2000, buying out the bank and moving the corporate headquarters to Tennessee. The bank was eventually bought out entirely by SunTrust. And today, few remember the bank that 20 years ago was the number one financial institution in Wake, Durham, Orange, Chatham, Franklin, and Johnson counties combined, according to the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation. It's a story that keeps playing out in the fast-growing area of the Triangle. Banks get bigger. Banks get bought. The names change, and once again, the big banks get bigger while tiny institutions compete for the dollars they're leaving behind. It shows you the power of just inertia in the mass market retail consumer banking business, says Scott Custer, chairman of Dogwood State Bank and former head of RBC Centura and Yadkin Financial. And he doesn't see it changing anytime soon. Regardless of what happens, those numbers tend to stay pretty static, he says. Think about your own account. To unwind your own personal checking, money market accounts, it's just a painful process to do it. And for the most part, unless something really unique happens, you tend to bank where you've been banking. And that means that even as people move into the region, they're bringing their existing banking relationships with them. A fact that's played out over the past 20 years with few outliers, FDIC figures show. But it's come at a cost. Community banks who couldn't keep up with the technology needed to stay relevant. And it's meant that an institution you banked with for a small loan 2 decades ago may have grown into a bank you don't recognize. The bank you used to frequent may have disappeared, as the Triangle region has lost more than 50 branches in the past decade, a casualty of industry consolidation and the digital banking shift. At the same time, the population has almost doubled, reflecting much smaller need for physical branches. Of the three top banks by deposits in the region in 2001, that's CCB, Wachovia, and BB&T, none remain in existence as an independent entity. Wachovia is now part of Wells Fargo. Wachovia is now part of Wells Fargo. BB&T, having combined with SunTrust, is now Truist Financial. And for the most part, it's the big banks taking advantage of the growth the Triangle is seeing, leaving some smaller players, such as Raleigh-based Trust Atlantic, acquired by First Horizon National, and Johnson County-based Four Oaks Financial, acquired by United Community Banks, to be gobbled up by regional players trying to enter the market. Three of the state's fastest growing counties are in the region: Johnson, Wake, and Durham. And everyone in the industry, from Comerica to Pinnacle to Town Bank, seems to want in. Combined, Wake, Durham, Johnson, Chatham, Orange, and Franklin counties gained more than 368,000 people over the past 10 years, the latest U.S. Census Bureau data show. Over the same time period, these counties also gained more than $39 billion in local deposits, FDIC data show, and most of those dollars went to the same handful of players. For the past 20 years, it's been largely the same story. Big banks are getting bigger in the Triangle, acquiring competitors. Wells Fargo, or Wachovia, and Truist, including its legacy banks, BB&T, SunTrust, and CCB, have been in the top three for the past two decades. Of the top five banks by deposits in the region 20 years ago, just Raleigh-based First Citizens Bank and Trust remains. And today, the deposit landscape is even more top-heavy. 20 years ago, the top three banks made up about half, or 49.5%, of the local deposits in Wake, Durham, Orange, Chatham, Johnson, and Franklin counties. And today, 56% of the deposits are split between three banks. Venture-focused Pacific West, which bought out Durham's Square One Bank, Wells Fargo, and Truist. Wells Fargo has long been the leader. We have reinvested in this community year after year after year, and I think people appreciate what our company does to support growth, says Mike Golden, regional president at Wells Fargo. The bank has long been a leader in the Raleigh Metro in particular, where it holds 22.6% of the deposits, down from 24.4% in 2020. It leads Truist by about 3 points in Raleigh, trailing it by 5 points in the Durham-Chapel Hill Metro. The Triangle has always been more of a competitive landscape than Charlotte, where Bank of America holds 61.9% of the Metro's entire market share. But the Triangle is still top-heavy, with a small group of banks accounting for the bulk of the dollars. And the top is getting even heftier as the population grows, data show. Prior to this year, the last time the top three added up to more than 51% was just before the recession in 2007, when the top players, then Wachovia, BB&T, and SunTrust, added up to 52.3% of the market. They've owned the physical distribution, the branch network, Custer says. They've got the size to invest in technology to take advantage of all the digitization that is going on today. Custer and others call PacWest the venture-focused bank that's been in the top three for about the past 5 years, an outlier. But he says the numbers show that for a community bank to be successful, it needs to stick with what it knows. He points to North State Bank, which has been able to build on its deposits and hold on to market share over the past two decades. What they did was just stay in their lane of traffic, Custer says. They just do it very well. Custer says market share is an irrelevant statistic compared to the performance of the bank itself. When it comes to community banks such as North State, which went from $91.9 million in regional deposits and 0.7% of the market in 2001 to more than $1 billion in deposits and a 1.5% stake in 2021. If you can maintain your market share in a real crowded market like North State has done, they can do very well and perform very well, he says. There's still room for community banks to have a piece of the market. Even though they have a small share, they can still compete and create good, high performance in their own companies by doing what it is they do well, following their own niche like PacWest, or whether it's just a good, consistent business model that they follow like a North State. And market share has never been how community banks measure their success, says CEO Harold Keene of KS Bank, which is based in Johnson County. Back in 2001, KS Bank had nearly 0.8% of the market and $100.7 million in deposits in the Triangle region. Today, its deposits have swelled to $341.1 million, though its market share is just 0.5%. Our focus has been on remaining an important part of our market and serving our market correctly, Keene says. We focused on our year-to-year growth and the contribution we make to the businesses and individuals that do business with us and our communities. And Keene says the demographics of its proximity to Research Triangle Park has been a major driver over the years. Its home county of Johnson is the fastest growing in the state, U.S. Census Bureau data show. Keene acknowledges that a lot of professionals moving into the area for jobs in the Triangle bring with them relationships to legacy banks. But he said the number one way KS gets customers is through referrals, specifically from relationships with small and medium-sized businesses. If you look at the chart, percentage-wise, we're slowly going down. But that's because every major financial institution in the country is trying to get to the Research Triangle market, he says. Obviously for us, it's more about how we're doing. Are we growing? Are we growing appropriately in the market we serve? We believe we are. And the numbers bear it out. While KS Bank may be losing market share, going from nearly 0.6% in 2017 to 0.5% as of June, its deposits are on the rise. During that same time period, the bank increased its deposits by about $111 million. And KS Bank has managed to keep its independence in decades where its peers, including its Johnson City neighbor, Four Oaks Bank, have folded into bigger institutions. But growth could soon get harder. Larry Barber, CEO of North State Bank, says relevance is the name of the game. And with many community bank deposit holders aging, appealing to young professionals is more critical than it's ever been. At North State, there's a big emphasis on transactional or core deposits, which makes up 96.2% of its deposit base, Barber says. When you're acquiring deposits that are relational in nature, they're going to grow with the market, he says. A lot of our growth has come from our customers who are steadfast in our relationships here. When the baby boomers leave, hopefully their money goes to someone we already know, and that gets back to the relationships, he says. A lot of our customers are like family. To ensure that the next generation signs on, the bank is making sizable investments in technology. Stacy Reedy, North State's chief financial officer, says it's critical for banks such as North State to meet customers where they are, and with millennials, that means online. Me being on the millennial side myself, even though I work at a bank, I don't do a lot of banking in the office per se, she says. North State's in the process of partnering with payment firm Zelle, for example, to stay relevant. Lee Burrows, Vice President of Investment Banking at Performance Trust Capital Partners in Atlanta, says a good banking experience for a young professional is being able to do their banking from home or at work. On the deposit side in particular, if not you're not giving young people a good banking experience through your technology, you're going to lose market share, he says. And Barber says a push for more diversity, too, keeps the bank relevant to the Triangle customer base. And that also means age diversity. The bank has brought in and promoted a slew of younger employees, Reedy included. Barber says it's not just about succession. It's also a push to bring in fresh ideas and to avoid complacency. The minute a community bank in particular becomes complacent about its deposit base, it's when you're going to go to a bad place, Barber says. Burroughs says diversity is mission critical. Not only does your management team, but your board needs to be diverse. Diverse across race, diverse in terms of gender, diverse in terms of age, because if you're not, you're missing an opportunity, he says. But Burroughs says deposits won't be the measure of success for community banks who get it right. Deposit breakdown is not indicative of where small businesses are doing their borrowing, he says. That's really what a small business person and even a consumer cares about. They want convenience for their deposits, but they want someone they know on the loan side. Big banks, too, are thinking outside of the box, and they're also making a push to reach underserved communities. Wells Fargo made a pledge last year to invest up to $50 million in black-owned banks. Durham's MFNF Bank Corps is a bank it's targeting. Similarly, Bank of America took a 4.9% stake in MNF, a $500,000 investment. And similar moves have been made by J.P. Morgan Chase and Citibank. These strategic partnerships allow us to potentially grow our asset size, increase investments in technology, strengthen our bank, and better serve our market, MNF CEO James Sills said last year. MNF, after years of declines, actually saw its assets jump in the past year amid a renewed awareness brought about by the social justice movement. The bank, once a central figure of Black Wall Street in Durham, had $100.3 million in Triangle Area deposits in 2001. That's just 0.75% of the market. While market share has stagnated over the years, it was just over 0.3% of the deposit stake in the Triangle region as of June. Deposits are now nearly $212.7 million in Wake, Durham, Chatham, Orange, Johnson, and Franklin counties combined. Just 2 years ago, they were $145.2 million, though the market share was virtually the same. But new competition could be coming as the Federal Paycheck Protection Program showed a rise in digital leaders. The only way to keep up is to invest in technology so that banks can meet customers where they are. And it's rarely a branch. It's absolutely critical, Burroughs said. And we have a couple little articles here on real estate, one entitled 600K and Up, High-End Homes Hit Wake Forest Market. A collection of high-end homes in a booming community in Wake Forest hit the market recently with prices starting in the 600,000s. On October the 18th, Toll Brothers announced the start of sales of its 25-home collection as a part of the growing Holden Village residential development south of downtown. And under the heading of Cary, the article, Industrial Plans Near Airport. A Raleigh real estate firm has filed plans for a large industrial development in Cary near Raleigh-Durham International Airport, joining an explosion in demand for flex and warehouse space across the triangle. Earlier this year, Raleigh-based Capital Associates filed plans for the Pleasant Grove Church Road Manufacturing Shell Building, calling for 120,000 square feet of industrial space at 3615 Pleasant Grove Church Road, which is on the north side of I-540 and near the site of a massive industrial park planned by the developer Merit. Well, as we near the end of our program this week, we get to the Viewpoint page. And one of the articles on that, of course, is the editor's notebook. This week, the editor's editorial is entitled First Signs of Parity in Housing Market Emerge. A friend of mine, who's a noted home appraiser here, told me recently for the first time this year, a home was sold close to the price of his appraisal. One sale is not a trend, he says, but he adds, at least now the companies may reflect the realities of home values in a few short months. I'm optimistic. Home appraisers rely heavily on sale prices of comparable houses in the neighborhood to determine the appraised value before a sale. This appraiser's point mirrors the findings of CoreLogic, a California business intelligence and analytic firm that found that 13% of the sold homes in the country had a sale contract above the appraised price in August. That number was about 20% in May, but only 7% in January of 2020. The gap has forced thousands of potential buyers off the market despite low interest rates because banks and mortgage firms required buyers to cover the difference of the appraised value and agreed upon sale price before closing. Often for borrowers, that meant tens of thousands of dollars in extra cash for homes priced between $250,000 and $400,000. The scenario also helped the single-family institutionalized investors with unlimited capital to swoop in and buy homes and offer them as rentals in communities. The market got so hot that it created a seismic shift in the iBuying market as companies such as Zillow, Opendoor, and others either stopped buying new homes or slowed down the pace of buying, fearing homes had gotten too rich to sustain margins during flip. We're now noticing the first wave of adjustments in the housing market that likely will slow down the rate of multiple offers on homes for sale and eventually the list price of homes as comparables start showing some level of parity. That by itself will likely eliminate the institutional investors because of the muted return on investment and an overbloated home portfolio in specific communities such as Raleigh, Phoenix, and Austin, Texas. If we see more of the contract sale amount in line with the appraised value, that's a huge bonus for buyers, who in recent months have been taking unusual risks, such as waiving their rights to terminate a contract because of low appraisal value. Essentially, these buyers were willing to plunk down more cash to make the sale happen. In June, according to the National Association of Realtors Survey of Agents, 28% of the buyers waived their appraisal contingency. But that percentage, too, should start coming down as the appraisal value and contract sales price start mirroring each other. After the housing bust that caused the Great Recession some 13 years ago, Congress enacted measures that offered appraisers independence and prohibited mortgage bankers from working with appraisers to match a price. That hurt the borrowers as home values went underwater and foreclosures skyrocketed to record levels. Chances are that the rules requiring the separation of mortgage bankers and appraisers may prevent the same level of housing market disaster this time around, although the securitization market may only be weeks away from facing a frenzied environment full of winners and losers. The housing market needed some signs of an equilibrium. We may not be there, and we may still be months away in certain parts of the country, but sale of a house close to its appraised value is a good start. Next, we come to the guest editorial for the Editor's Viewpoint page, and this week's editorial is entitled Behind the September Jobs Report, and is written by Kristen Brody, who's a fellow of the Metropolitan Policy Program at Brookings. The Bureau of Labor Statistics September Jobs Report released last week showed a decrease of 0.4 percentage points in the U.S. unemployment rate, from 5.2% in August to 4.8% in September. Total non-farm payroll employment increased by $194,000 in September, compared to a monthly average of $561,000, and the number of unemployed people fell by 710,000. The number of marginally attached workers increased by 167,000, and the number of discouraged workers increased by 58,000. The uptick in marginally attached and discouraged workers suggests that the official unemployment rate understates how many workers are currently having trouble finding jobs. Given this difficulty, it's not surprising that the labor force participation rate, which is 61.6%, has remained static, with BLS reporting that the rate has remained within the narrow range of 61.4% to 61.7% since June of 2020. Likewise, the number of workers who are part-time for economic reasons, that's 4.5 million, meaning workers who would like to be full-time but have had their hours cut or who can't find full-time jobs, remain largely unchanged compared to last month. Finally, the number of people not currently in the labor force but who want a job, that's 6 million, has also remained largely unchanged. These disappointing job numbers further underscore the mistake of ending the expanded unemployment insurance program. Unlike the predictions made by proponents of that measure, scaling back support for unemployed persons did not lead to a substantial increase in employment. This is because there are simply not enough jobs currently available, whether because of ongoing supply chain disruptions in production, the impact of the Delta variant on consumer demand for services, or various other factors. On October the 1st, President Joe Biden touted steady progress, widespread improvement, and increased employment over the first 8 months of his presidency. The president pointed out that the unemployment rate for black workers in September was below 8% for the first time in 17 months. However, the unemployment rate for black workers remains 3.1 percentage points higher than the national average and 1.9 percentage point above its level in February of 2020. So there's still progress to be made in the economic recovery to return black workers to their pre-pandemic employment levels. But the goal should not be solely a return to pre-pandemic levels of employment, a level that has historically been higher than the national average. The goal should be to shift labor dynamics and end systemic and structural racism and discrimination that have led to the racial disparities in employment that we see today. Biden also discussed increased wages. Real average hourly earnings increased 0.4% between July and August, according to research from the Pew Research Center. Despite the severity of the economic shock created by the COVID-19 pandemic, earnings of employed workers overall were largely unaffected, in part because large lower wage earners experienced deeper job issues. Research from our colleagues at the Brookings Institution found pandemic and job losses hit low wage workers much harder than those earning higher wages, and low wage jobs have been the slowest to return. While the vaccination rate is increasing and hospitalizations are down, more needs to be done to get Americans back to work in the pandemic and tackle the racial employment gap. Well, that music means we've run out of time for today's episode. I hope you enjoyed it. I'm Alton Banks, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The Triangle Business Journal is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. Once again, that number is 919-832-5138. So long until next time. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.